Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hi there, Herman and Corin. So one of the news events this week just concluded was the always comical Michael O'Leary of Ryanair, the low-budget Irish carrier who I once vowed I would never fly on again. And for legal reasons, we won't be disclosing that, but no frills. They really take no frills to the next level. I actually had I will disclose a story. It's not that exciting. I had a flight booked with them that they cancelled and then refused to offer any compensation. And if I'm not mistaken, we actually won in some way. It was like an out-of-court thing. But I had to file for court, which is kind of crazy, to get my holiday recompensated. So I don't have great love for Ryanair. But their always combative and rambunctious CV, O'Leary, was in a feud with Elon Musk. So you can kind of make this feud up as two very intriguing characters, I believe, bickering just over the internet. And the core of the story was that airlines are adopting LEO. So in order to offer in-flight Wi-Fi, to pick up Starlink, just like the rest of us, I guess, well, not quite like the rest of us. Well, that's what we're going to talk about today. They have to have the tech to receive it, as opposed to other forms of satellite internet, which would be a great topic for another episode. There's never a shortage of weird topics for us to get into. But for Starlink specifically, and the big carriers, British, you know, the normal, the what's left of the respectable airlines of the world, diminishing pool, they're integrating Starlink and offering it to their customers. And O'Leary has refused. He makes claims that the receiver would be the fuel consumption that it would increase it by would make it unprofitable, and that was an allegation that was strongly refuted by Starlink, saying that O'Leary's estimates as to the fuel load are just incorrect, and that it's not a very substantial difference. And then he kind of backtracked a bit and said, well, you know what, our passengers are just not going to pay for it. So they'll content themselves with eating paninis and hearing announcements about Ryanair's in-flight lottery. So that was the end of that feud. But it is an interesting topic because it always amazes me whenever I've connected to in-flight internet, how is this even possible? It's one thing that internet coming from satellites is pretty fascinating, but Herman and Corin, I actually had early experience with satellite internet because in rural Ireland, where there was no other alternative, there was a satellite provider that I think we subscribed to for a while when I was growing up. And I remember it being really, it was an expensive subscription and the bandwidth was tiny. Like you had to kind of measure, not use too much of it. And it was painfully slow, even back then when the internet was kind of a small thing. So satellite is now mainstream thanks to LEO technology, really kind of catalyzed by Starlink. That aspect is pretty amazing, that you have these things orbiting around the Earth and that's how we're picking up internet and then relaying it back to down stations, which we talked about before, the internet being one big kind of just lump of networks. And the fact that it kind of goes through the sky, then across fiber, then to a server, then back through the sky is crazy when you think about it. And that it can do so with any latency that is halfway acceptable is literally a miracle of engineering. But what's a second miracle of engineering is how the receiver can continue to pick up and transmit packets while it's moving at the speed of a jet. That's a second miracle. And that's what I'd love to get into today. I mean, I guess we could ask the same question. How do you maintain cellular connectivity when you're driving? You're moving between different towers and there's a handoff between towers, but you're not seeing any of that stuff happen. It's all happening at the network operator level. I guess it's a bit like we talked about mesh networks before and moving between them. But you know, at the LEO level, it's really kind of crazy tech. So how does that work exactly, Herman and Corin? If you are aboard a Boeing 737 or 757, and you're cruising at an altitude of 30,000 feet, I guess it doesn't make an appreciable difference to how far the signal has to go, given the satellites are so far up. But does it make a difference? The atmosphere is going to be clearly very different to if you were trying to pick up Starlink on the ground. It's going to be a lot colder, for one, and there's a lot less oxygen in the air, for two. Does that make any difference as to why they need specialized receivers? But more pertinently, the sheer speed at which the receiver is traveling. It's not a stationary object like a Starlink that's on your roof is. It's moving at a fast pace. And how does that dance work, whereby you've got a receiver up in the air? Its altitude is changing at certain points of the flight during descent and ascent, and is moving very quickly. And someone sitting in row 12, who succeeds in watching Netflix, my classic boring internet example, and during that process receives packets from Netflix across the sky to their computer without any drops. That is an insane miracle if that happens, and I've seen it happen. So how does that work exactly, Herman and Corin? Let's talk about the miraculous physics that are required to keep connectivity to Starlink when you're flying in the air at a very fast speed. Herman and Corin, let's talk LEO connectivity in the air. Over to both of you.
Hey everyone, welcome back to My Weird Prompts. I'm Corin, coming to you from our home in Jerusalem, and I have to say, I have been looking forward to this one all morning. The weather here is finally clearing up, and the view over the old city is just spectacular today.
And I am Herman Poppleberry. Good to be here, Corin. We have a really juicy topic today that actually just blew up in the news over the last week. Our housemate Daniel sent us a voice note about this after seeing the latest back and forth between Michael O'Leary and Elon Musk. It is one of those rare moments where a corporate spat actually highlights a massive shift in how we interact with the world, or in this case, the sky.
It is such a classic clash of personalities, right? You have got O'Leary, the king of low-cost, no-frills travel at Ryanair, basically calling Musk an idiot on Irish radio because of the technical requirements of putting Starlink on planes. And then you have Musk being, well, Musk, firing back on X and calling O'Leary an utter idiot, and even joking about buying Ryanair just to fire him. But beneath all that corporate theater and the buy the airline memes is a genuinely fascinating technical question that Daniel wanted us to dig into.
Exactly. Daniel was asking how this actually works. How do you keep a stable, high-speed internet connection when you are on a plane moving at 800 kilometers per hour, while the satellites themselves are screaming across the sky at 27,000 kilometers per hour? It is a double-moving target problem, and the physics required to solve it are honestly pretty mind-blowing. We are talking about tracking a target the size of a suitcase from 500 kilometers away, while both objects are moving in different vectors at supersonic speeds.
Right, because for the longest time, in-flight Wi-Fi was just terrible. It was slow, it was expensive, and it would cut out the moment you left the coast. I remember paying $20 for a flight across the Atlantic only to find out I could barely load a text, only email. But now we are seeing claims of 200 to 500 megabits per second at 35,000 feet. So, Herman, for those who might not be up on the latest orbital mechanics, why is the new low Earth orbit system so much better than what we had before?
It really comes down to the difference between GEO and LEO. Traditionally, planes use geostationary satellites, or GEO. Those are massive satellites parked 35,786 kilometers away in space. Because they are so far out, they appear to stay in the same spot in the sky relative to the ground, which makes them easy to point at. But the problem is distance. At 35,000 kilometers, the signal has to travel about 70,000 kilometers round trip. Even at the speed of light, that creates a massive delay or latency. You are looking at 600 to 800 milliseconds of lag. That is why your video calls would always fail, and why even a simple web page took forever to load. The handshake between your computer and the server just timed out.
And Starlink is much closer, right? Like, significantly closer.
Way closer. Low Earth orbit, or LEO, is only about 550 kilometers up. In fact, SpaceX just announced they are lowering some of their newer V3 satellites to 480 kilometers to improve safety and deorbit times. That is over 60 times closer than geostationary satellites. So, the signal travel time drops from nearly a second down to about 30 or 40 milliseconds. It is basically the same latency you get with home fiber. But, and this is the big catch Daniel was hitting on, because they are so low, they are moving incredibly fast relative to the ground. They are not parked anymore, they are flying past you at 17,000 miles per hour.
So, it is like trying to have a conversation with someone while you are both on different high-speed trains going in different directions, and you're trying to throw a ball back and forth through the windows.
That is exactly the right analogy. A single Starlink satellite is only in view of the plane for a few minutes before it disappears over the horizon. So, the plane has to constantly hand off the connection from one satellite to the next without the passenger noticing a drop in their Netflix stream. If that handoff takes more than a few milliseconds, your connection drops. It is a logistical nightmare of timing and precision.
Let us talk about that handoff for a second. Because if I am on a plane, I am moving at 500 miles per hour. The satellite is moving at 17,000 miles per hour. How does the receiver on the roof of the plane even find the next satellite that quickly? It's not like there's a guy up there with a joystick.
This is where the hardware gets really interesting. On old planes, you would see these big, bulbous humps on the top of the fuselage. Inside those humps were actual physical satellite dishes that used motors to mechanically tilt and point at the satellite. But motors are slow. They take seconds to move, they have mechanical wear and tear, and they break easily. Plus, they add a ton of drag.
I remember those. They looked like a little radome blister on the plane's back. They were quite prominent.
Precisely. But the new Starlink Aero Terminal is completely different. It is an electronically steered phased array antenna. It is a flat panel that has no moving parts at all. Instead of moving the dish, it uses thousands of tiny antenna elements that work together. By slightly shifting the timing, or the phase, of the signal sent to each of those tiny antennas, the terminal can steer the beam electronically. It uses constructive and destructive interference to point the signal in a specific direction without moving an inch.
Wait, so it's basically using math to bend the radio waves?
Exactly. It is the Huygens-Fresnel principle in action. By changing the phase by just a few nanoseconds across the array, the terminal can point at a new satellite in less than 1 millisecond.
Less than 1 millisecond? That is faster than a literal blink of an eye.
It is nearly instantaneous. So, while you are flying, the terminal is actually tracking multiple satellites at once. It is talking to one, but it is already looking at the next one. When the first one starts to get too low in the sky, it just flips the data stream to the next one in a fraction of a millisecond. To your laptop in seat 12B, it looks like one continuous connection. It is so seamless that you can play a fast-paced online game like Counter-Strike or Helldivers 2 while crossing the Atlantic, and you won't even notice the handoff.
That explains the stability, but what about the speed? Daniel's prompt mentioned the varying altitudes and high speeds. Does the speed of the plane itself cause problems with the frequency of the radio waves, like the Doppler effect? I remember that from high school physics.
You nailed it. That is a huge technical challenge. It is the same reason a police siren sounds high-pitched when it is coming toward you and low-pitched when it moves away. At these speeds, where the relative velocity between the plane and the satellite can be over 18,000 miles per hour, the radio frequency actually shifts. If the terminal and the satellite don't account for that Doppler shift, the data gets scrambled because the receiver is looking for the signal on the wrong frequency.
So, how do they fix it? Do they just guess the shift?
No, they use a massive amount of real-time math. The terminal on the plane has a built-in GPS and an inertial navigation system. It knows exactly where the plane is, what its altitude is, and exactly how fast it is moving in three-dimensional space. At the same time, it has a map of the entire Starlink constellation, which, as of today, January 23, 26, is over 9,400 satellites. It knows where every single one of them is and exactly how fast they are moving.
So it calculates the expected frequency shift before the signal even arrives.
Exactly. It uses a field programmable gate array, or FPGA, to compensate for that frequency shift in real time. It pre-tunes the receiver to the shifted frequency. This is why you can maintain a connection even during takeoff or a steep descent when the altitude and velocity are changing rapidly. The terminal is constantly adjusting for the changing distance and the relativistic-like shifts in the signal. It is a level of precision that was simply impossible 10 years ago.
That is incredible. Now, let us get into the drama Daniel mentioned. Michael O'Leary from Ryanair had a very public spat with Elon Musk about this. O'Leary claims that putting these antennas on his planes would cost him a 2% fuel penalty because of the weight and the aerodynamic drag. He basically said the cost isn't worth it for a low-cost carrier. Is he right? Is the drag that bad?
Well, this is where the numbers get contentious. O'Leary says 2%. If you are Ryanair and you spend $5.5 billion a year on fuel, 2% is an extra $110 million. That is a huge hit to your margins. But SpaceX's Vice President of Engineering, Michael Nichols, actually fired back on social media last week saying, their analysis shows the fuel increase for a Boeing 737 is only about 0.3%.
That is a massive difference. 2% versus 0.3%. Someone is either being very pessimistic or very optimistic.
It really is. Nichols pointed out that O'Leary's 2% figure might be accurate for the old, bulky mechanical radomes, the ones that look like a giant hump. But the Starlink Aero Terminal is much lower profile. It is only about an inch or two thick, and it sits relatively flat against the fuselage. Starlink actually argues that because it is so light, under 60 pounds, and so thin, the drag is negligible compared to the old systems. In fact, Qatar Airways just finished retrofitting their entire fleet of Boeing 777s and Airbus A350s, and they claim the installation only takes about 10 hours per plane now. That is 10 times faster than the old systems.
And O'Leary's point was also about the no-frills model. He said his passengers won't pay even €1 for internet, so why bother with the drag? But then you look at airlines like United or Air France or Qatar Airways, and they are rolling it out for free. United is equipping more than one plane per day right now.
Right, and those airlines are seeing it as a competitive advantage. If you are choosing between 2 6-hour flights and one has free, high-speed Wi-Fi that actually works, you are going to pick that one every time. United expects to have 450 mainline aircraft fitted with Starlink by the end of this year. They are betting that the United Next strategy of premium service will win out. But for O'Leary, every cent counts. He even said he would pay no attention to Musk because Musk knows nothing about flights and drag.
It sounds like O'Leary might be using old data, or maybe he is just being intentionally difficult to negotiate a better price. He is known for that. He's the guy who suggested charging people to use the toilet, after all.
Oh, absolutely. It is very Jerusalem-style arguing, actually. Very passionate. But technically speaking, the Aero Terminal is a massive step forward in efficiency. It's not just about the internet, it's about the weight-to-performance ratio.
One thing I am curious about, and I think Daniel was hinting at this too, is what happens when you are in the middle of the ocean. There are no ground stations in the middle of the Atlantic or the Pacific. In the old days, that meant you lost your connection or had to rely on a very slow GEO link. How does Starlink solve the middle of nowhere? Problem?
That is where the space lasers come in. And I know that sounds like a science fiction trope, but it is very real. The newer Starlink satellites are equipped with optical inter-satellite links, or ISLs.
Space lasers? I love it. Tell me more. How many lasers are we talking about?
There are over 9,000 lasers in orbit right now. Each satellite has multiple laser terminals that can sustain a 100 gigabit per second connection per link. So, if you are a plane over the middle of the Pacific, your terminal talks to a satellite directly above you. That satellite might not be able to see a ground station on Earth. So, it uses a laser to beam your data to another satellite nearby, which beams it to another one, and another one, until it finds a satellite that is currently over a ground station in, say, Japan or California.
So, they have built a literal mesh network in space. Your data is hopping from satellite to satellite at the speed of light.
Exactly. These laser links can stay connected over distances of 5,000 kilometers. They are so precise they can maintain a link even while the satellites are moving at 17,000 miles per hour. This is why you can now get gate-to-gate connectivity. You don't have to wait until you are at cruising altitude anymore because the system doesn't need to wait for a clear line of sight to a specific ground station. It just finds the fastest path through the mesh.
That is a huge change. I remember the announcement from Air Baltic. They were the first European airline to offer that gate-to-gate service. And now Qatar Airways has connected over 11 million passengers with this tech just in the last year. It really changes the experience of travel if you don't have that dead zone during taxi and takeoff. You can finish your Zoom call while the plane is literally pulling away from the gate.
It also changes things for the pilots. For pilots, having an always-on, high-bandwidth pipe means they can get real-time weather maps and updated flight paths instantly. They aren't relying on old-school radio bursts or slow satellite pings. It makes the whole flight safer and more efficient. They can even stream high-def video of the landing gear or other external sensors to ground technicians in real-time if there is an issue.
So, we have the phased array steering the beam in a millisecond, the FPGA compensating for the Doppler shift from the 800 km per hour speed, and the space lasers routing data over the ocean. It really is a feat of engineering. But let's look at the downsides. Is there anything that can still knock this connection out? What about weather? I know my old satellite TV used to cut out whenever it rained.
Weather is still a factor, but less so than you might think. Starlink uses the Ku-band for its primary communication. While heavy rain or thick clouds can cause some signal attenuation, being at 35,000 feet actually puts you above most of the weather. You are literally flying above the clouds that would normally block a ground-based user. The only time you really face weather interference is during the initial climb or the final approach.
That is a fair point. You are already through the thickest part of the atmosphere for 90% of the flight.
Exactly. The main challenge at altitude is actually the handover density. In busy flight corridors, like the one between New York and London, you might have hundreds of planes all trying to talk to the same few satellites. Starlink has to manage that capacity dynamically, constantly shifting beams to make sure no single satellite gets overwhelmed. They are moving 10 petabytes of data every single day across that network.
It is like a massive game of musical chairs. But with gigabits of data, and everyone is moving at Mach 0.8.
And the chairs are also moving at 17,000 miles per hour. It is a logistical nightmare that is only solved by massive automation. There is no human in a control room doing this. It is all handled by the network's internal logic and AI-driven beam management.
So, thinking about Daniel's question about maintaining a stable connection, it really is this invisible dance between the plane's GPS, the satellite's orbital data, and the electronic steering of the antenna. If any of those pieces fail, the whole thing falls apart.
Right. If the plane's GPS glitched and the terminal thought it was 5 miles away from where it actually was, it would point the beam at the wrong spot in the sky and the connection would drop instantly. The precision required is incredible. We are talking about pointing a beam with a width of just a few degrees at a target 500 kilometers away while both of you are moving. It's like trying to hit a moving fly with a laser pointer from across a football stadium while you're on a merry-go-round.
It reminds me of the discussion we had way back in episode 9 about fine-tuning systems. This is like the hardware version of that fine-tuning the physical alignment of a signal in real time.
It really is. And the result is that we are finally seeing the death of the offline flight. For some people, that is a tragedy. They liked the forced isolation of a long-haul flight. They liked having an excuse not to answer emails for 10 hours.
I'm one of those people who misses the quiet, honestly. There was something peaceful about being unreachable, but I can't deny the tech is impressive. Let us talk about the takeaways here. If someone is listening to this and they are about to book a flight, what should they actually look for if they want this kind of experience?
Well, the first thing is to check the airline. United Airlines is the big one in the US right now. They are putting it on over 1,000 aircraft. Hawaiian Airlines already has it on their long-haul flights. Air Baltic is the leader in Europe, and Air France is catching up fast. They expect their entire fleet to be done by the end of 26. Qatar Airways is the global leader for wide-body planes. If you see Starlink on the amenities list, you can expect speeds around 150 to 250 megabits per second and latency low enough for a Zoom call.
And what about the cost? Is it always going to be free? Or is that just a temporary perk to get us hooked?
The trend is leaning toward free, but often with a catch. For example, Air France requires you to be a Flying Blue member. It's a way to drive loyalty. But because the cost per bit for Starlink is so much lower than the old GEO systems, airlines can afford to give it away as a perk. It is becoming like the free peanuts of the digital age. If you don't offer it, you look behind the times. Even Lufthansa is rushing to catch up now, though they say it will take them until 2029 to finish their fleet.
Unless you are Ryanair, apparently. O'Leary would probably charge you for the oxygen if he could get away with it.
Well, Michael O'Leary is a special case, but even he might be forced to pivot. Imagine if EasyJet or Southwest starts offering free Starlink. Ryanair would have to follow suit or lose the business traveler market entirely. No business traveler is going to sit on a 2-hour flight without Wi-Fi if the competitor has it for free.
It is interesting how the technology is driving the economics. By making the terminal lighter and the service cheaper, SpaceX has essentially forced the airline industry's hand. And now they are testing direct-to-cell capabilities with their V3 satellites. In the future, you might not even need the plane's Wi-Fi. Your phone might just talk directly to a satellite through the cabin window.
That is the next frontier. But for now, that aero terminal on the roof is the gold standard. It's a piece of tech that weighs less than a standard checked bag but connects you to a global mesh network of lasers and silicon.
So to summarize for Daniel, the stability comes from sub-millisecond electronic beam steering. The speed comes from being 60 times closer to Earth than old satellites. The global coverage comes from space lasers. And the moving target problem is solved by high-speed math and Doppler compensation.
That is the My Weird Prompt summary in a nutshell. It is a combination of orbital mechanics, radio physics, and a very public billionaire feud. It's the most high-tech soap opera in the world.
I love it. And hey, if you are listening to this on a plane right now using Starlink, first of all, that is meta as heck. Second of all, let us know how it's working. You can find the contact form on our website at myweirdprompts.com.
Yeah, we would love to hear some real-world benchmarks from our listeners. Are you actually getting those 200 megabit speeds? Is it stable during turns? We've heard reports of people getting up to 500 megabits on Qatar Airways. Is that true?
Actually, that is a great question. Does the plane tilting during a turn affect the connection? If the plane banks at 30 degrees, does the antenna lose the satellite?
It can, but the phased array antenna is designed to compensate for that. It can scan up to 60 degrees off-center. So unless the pilot is doing some serious stunt flying or a very steep tactical descent, the antenna can usually stay locked onto the satellite even during a standard bank or turn. The math just adjusts the phase of the elements to look sideways.
Man, the more we dig into this, the more I realize how much work is happening. Just so I can scroll through social media at 30,000 feet. It is a lot of effort for my cat videos.
It is a triumph of human ingenuity dedicated to the most mundane tasks imaginable. But that is the beauty of it, right? We build these incredible systems so that the complex stuff becomes invisible. You shouldn't have to think about FPGAs and Doppler shifts. You should just be able to watch your movie.
Well said, Herman Poppleberry. And I think that is a perfect place to wrap this up. Daniel, thanks for sending in such a timely prompt. It was great to finally have an excuse to talk about space lasers and Michael O'Leary in the same sentence. It really made my morning.
It was a highlight of my week, honestly. And hey, if you have been enjoying the show and you are a regular listener, we would really appreciate it if you could leave us a quick review on your podcast app or on Spotify. It genuinely helps the show reach new people who are as curious as we are. We are trying to hit 10,000 reviews by the end of the year.
Yeah, it really does make a difference. You can also find all of our past episodes, including the one on fine-tuning we mentioned, at myweirdprompts.com. We have got an RSS feed there for subscribers, too, and some cool merch if you want a Space Lasers t-shirt.
All right, I think that is it for today. This has been My Weird Prompts.
Thanks for listening, everyone. We will see you next time. Stay curious.
Until next time.
So, Herman, do you think O'Leary is actually going to buy a Starlink kit for his house just to see if it works? Or is he too cheap for the monthly fee?
I think he'd try to negotiate a no-frills version of Starlink that only connects on Tuesdays and requires him to pedal a bike to power the terminal.
Low Earth orbit, but you have to stand on one leg to get a signal.
Exactly. Priority bandwidth costs an extra 10 euros, and you have to bring your own Ethernet cable.
Well, whatever the case, I'm just glad we don't have to pay for the Wi-Fi in this house. Although, with Daniel's data usage, maybe we should start charging him.
Amen to that. See ya, Corin.
See ya, Herman.
And thanks again to Daniel for the prompt. We'll have to tell him the full space laser story over dinner. I think he'll be interested in the V3 upgrades.
Oh, he's gonna love it. He's a sucker for anything with the word laser in it. He still has that laser pointer from the 90s.
Aren't we all? All right, signing off for real this time. Bye.
Bye.
My Weird Prompts is a collaborative production. For more information, visit myweirdprompts.com.
And remember, no question is too weird. Keep them coming. We love the technical ones.
Safe travels, everyone, whether you're on the ground or at 35,000 feet.
Hopefully with good Wi-Fi.
Hopefully. Bye.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.